Thank you, Robert. There's more to talk about, and we'd like to have you back, as always. We've been speaking with Robert Naiman with Just Foreign Policy. A link to that website is on the KBOO website, where you can read more. The deal with the Iran is certainly to be welcomed, and we want to talk more about possible Israeli involvement further down the road. Thanks so much again for that, Robert. This has been a Cascadia for Monday, November 25th, 2013. Sam Parrish engineered the show today. Thanks for that, Sam. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. I'm Chris Andre. Get the facts, know your rights, take a stand. Thanks for listening and stay tuned.
This Tuesday at 8 a.m. on the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, we'll talk with a Navy veteran who experienced sexual abuse at the hands of an officer and who fought long and hard to get compensation and justice. All this and more on call-in radio, Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, this Tuesday, 8 a.m.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to help co-sponsor the Triangle production of American Fiesta, starring Gary Wayne Cash, a witty, hopeful tale of imperfection and acceptance. American Fiesta will take place at the Sanctuary at Sandy Plaza, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. This Triangle production will run from November 29th through December 22nd. More information about this KBOO-sponsored event may be found at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Wilkin & Company, PC, Certified Public Accountants, helping businesses, individuals, and nonprofit organizations make financial decisions based on their personal values since 1987. Wilkin & Company is located at 2435 Southwest 5th Avenue in Portland. Information at 503-225-1359 or wilkincpas.com.
Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. The Halley Research Station, a profoundly isolated British research station in Antarctica, is so remote, it's said that it's easier to evacuate a casualty from the International Space Station than it is to bring someone out of Halley in the winter. A small group of people winter over each year along this portion of the Antarctic coast. Their sole companions are thousands of emperor penguins, the only animal that has evolved to endure and breed during the harsh Antarctic winter. This morning, my guest is Gavin Francis, a doctor who spent 14 months at the Halley Research Station. His memoir, Empire Antarctica, follows the emperor penguins throughout the year from a summer of perpetual sunshine to months of winter darkness and shares his experiences of this world of great beauty conjured from the simplest of elements. Gavin, welcome to Locus Focus.
Thank you for having me on, Barbara.
Well, you make a big point in your book about how emperor penguins are really the only animals that have evolved so that they can endure, survive, and actually breed during the Antarctic winter. So why is it that so many human beings have found the fascination with Antarctica and have tried to figure out how to spend the winter there as well?
Well, that's a very big question. There is something magnificent about Antarctica. I think something connected to its purity, its enormity, its simplicity. And people have felt the same attraction to go to the Antarctic as they have for many centuries. felt about going to the Arctic. I mean, if you read the old Arctic exploration stories from the 16th, 17th centuries, people talk in the same terms as they nowadays talk about going to the Antarctic. I think that we do have a great responsibility when we go there because it is so pure and untouched, and we have to do the very best that we can not to make it polluted in any way. And I think that there's an important reason to go there too, because some of the research stations are doing work there that are telling us all sorts of science about the way that the planet is going. So it's useful to have people there too.
Well, it seems to me one big difference between the Arctic and the Antarctic is that there are the Arctic is surrounded by nations, many that have been settled and developed for centuries and perhaps millennia, whereas the Antarctic is isolated off by itself. And I wonder if you see that the Antarctic's isolation, as I guess you could call it the other island continent besides Australia, makes it that much more tantalizing even than the Arctic.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, when we live, I wrote a book about the Arctic too, but the European Arctic, certainly Greenland and Lapland, Svalbard. And the Arctic has always been known about by the people to the south of it, because you can get there by traveling. You know, you pick a landmass, either Siberia or Scandinavia or Canada, and you just keep going north, and eventually you get there. Whereas Antarctica, even in the early 19th century, nobody was sure there was even a continent there at all. Captain Cook thought there was probably some land down there in the 18th century, because he saw these enormous icebergs and thought that they betrayed the sign that there must have been land. But nobody actually saw the land until well into the 19th century. And then nobody realized there was a continent there until only 100 years ago. That was the Scott Discovery Expedition. So there is certainly something in the human imagination that makes us very, very much attracted to Antarctica, because the remoteness is all tied up with a very real difficulty of getting there and living there. And we have no traditions of living there. I mean, railways, electric lights, these things have got a longer cultural history than Antarctica does.
Well, it also seems another difference between the Arctic and the Antarctic is that the poles, actually the North Pole is not on land, is that correct? Whereas the South Pole is on land. And I wonder if that gives a difference in terms of being able to stand in a place, which I understand you didn't get to do, at the very bottom of the earth, so to speak.
Yeah, that's right. And the North Pole stands on the Arctic Ocean, so it's nearly always frozen there, and it's getting the sea ice is moving more and more each year because of climate change in the North Pole. But you can go and stand there, but you're standing on moving ice, whereas the South Pole is about 3,000 meters up. It's on an enormous continental plateau. Beneath your feet when you stand there are kilometers, miles thick of solid freshwater glacial ice. And so I think that too held something of an attraction for the first Antarctic explorers. When they first went there 100 years ago, they hoped the South Pole was on the sea as the North Pole was. It would have made it a lot easier to get to. They hoped that the South Pole would be able to ski along sea ice to get to, but they found, of course, there was this enormous ridge of barrier mountains, 3,000 metres up, and that the expedition was going to be a lot more difficult than they'd hoped.
Well, a lot of people have lost their lives going to both poles, and I think maybe I read a book, actually, a couple of years ago about the explorers in the Arctic, and it was interesting to me because I never was really myself caught up in the mystique of getting to the Arctic, but to see, you know, how much it captured, particularly the American imagination, was very interesting. The Antarctic, it seems like it has even a more stunning history of people challenging themselves and often being fatally challenged in getting there. And what if you could talk a little bit about how people, what it took to find the Antarctic continent and what it took to actually get to the South Pole?
Sure. Well, to find the Antarctic continent, as I said, it was there was a British naval expedition in the early 19th century. It was a guy called James Clark Ross. James Clark Ross was a British Navy guy who took these two ships, Erebus and Terror, down south into the Ross Sea. It's so that part south of Australia and New Zealand. And he saw the land, he saw the tips of the mountains in the distance, but he couldn't get that close. And his report back to London really whetted a lot of appetites. By the end of the 19th century, there began to be some more expeditions. But it wasn't really until Scott's expedition, Captain Scott's, arrived in about 1902, 1903, and he was really keen to get to the South Pole with Shackleton. Shackleton was on his expedition on the first one. And they made this wonderful sledging journey across the Ross Ice Barrier, where they realized that actually the South Pole was going to be up on the plateau. It wasn't going to be that easy to get to after all. And so they didn't make it on that trip. They came back. Shackleton actually got scurvy and had to be invalided out, a fact for which he never forgave Scott, apparently. And then Shackleton himself returned in 1907, 1908, and he that was the Nimrod expedition, and he almost made it. He made it within 100 miles of the South Pole, but he ran out of food and fuel. And so he turned back rather than risk his men's lives. Got within, as I say, a few miles, came back, got back to the civilization 1909. And then the Scott expedition that had the so-called race with Amundsen set off in 1911, 1912. And they did get to the South Pole, but of course they were beaten to it by the Norwegian expedition under Amundsen. And Scott and all his party died on the way back because they didn't have quite enough stores and because the weather turned very much against them. You mentioned speaking in particular about the American imagination. There's a marvelous American explorer, Admiral Byrd, Richard Byrd, who I'm sure many of your listeners will know about. And for me, Byrd, who he went to Antarctica in the late 20s, early 30s, he was the first to use aeroplanes to map the Antarctic. In only one day of flying in the Antarctic, he covered more of the continent than all the landbound expeditions had managed before him. And he was one of the first, I think, to really appreciate the potential of the continent for the human imagination, for the metaphor that it seemed to represent, that purity and simplicity. For example, he chose to man one of the deep field meteorological stations all alone for 4.5-5 months, just to experience that isolation and that solitude to the full. And he wrote a very beautiful book about it, a book called Alone. So yes, Americans have got a long tradition of that in that early phase of Antarctic exploration too.
Well, this morning, if you're just tuning in, we're talking on Locus Focus here with Gavin Francis, who's the author of a book called Empire Antarctica, Ice, Silence, and the Emperor Penguins. And we're talking about the really unique qualities of that continent far to the south. Mm. I guess when we think about Antarctica, perhaps the first thing that comes to mind is isolation, which you just described with Byrd's book Alone. And then there are the extremes of brightness and darkness, and then there's all that ice. And I wonder how those three things all kind of tie up together in your experiences when you were there.
Well, I was the doctor at Halley Research Station, which is a very small, very remote British research station, which was the place that actually discovered the ozone hole back in 1985. So very far south, 75 degrees south. And at 75 degrees in the Antarctic, you have about 3.5 months in the summer of constant sunlight with the sun above the horizon. But conversely, in winter, you have 3.5 months with the sun below the horizon, so it's dark. And because Halley is on a continental ice shelf, there is only ice and sky. It's the most magnificent, pure landscape. It's a sort of binary world of only ice and sky. And because the ice is so filled with light, and the sky is so filled with light, the two reflect one another in a very kind of dreamlike way. When you're walking around and skiing and making expeditions in the Antarctic, you're moving between light and light. And I found that experience, that isolation, being unable to get out and that nobody could get in, and that I lived in this world of mirrors, essentially, a mirrored sky and a mirrored continent of ice, that it made the most, it gave me the most incredible impressions and the most incredible experiences of the way light changes through the year. And I should say, actually, that the darkness in the Antarctic, the 3.5 months when the sun is below the horizon, are some of the most beautiful times. I mean, that's the time when the sky floods with auroras, aurora australis, just as in the north you have aurora borealis, in the south you have aurora australis, and Halley experiences one of the highest frequencies of auroral storms anywhere in the world. And the light phenomena in the sky, the halos around the full moon, moon pillars, meteor showers, the fact that because it's dark 24 hours a day, you can really get an appreciation of the wheel of the constellations through the 24 hours because the movement of the night sky, the way it turns, is never interrupted by day. You can get a real appreciation for it. Now, somebody told me that they thought my book was essentially a book about light. And I see what they mean. You know, the descriptions in my book that try and convey this to the reader of what it's really like to experience a winter at 75 degrees south and almost alone is essentially an account of how the light changes.
Well, it also seems that in the summer in Antarctica, it's just as challenging, if not more challenging, in your description of not being able to get away from the light. And I wonder, what was that like?
Yeah, well, the base where I lived, it's very well equipped with good quality blackout blinds. When you're out camping and on expeditions, of course, you end up sleeping with a hat pulled down over your eyes most of the time. And the constant glaring, blinding light in the summertime has odd effects as well on the body clock. It's as if your body can't quite find itself, the right mooring in the day, because it always feels like it's in the full flood of noon. A lot of people find that their sleep becomes very disturbed during the winter, because because of the relentless light.
During the summer, you mean?
Yes, during the summer.
Now, as the doctor on the base, did you find yourself having to treat some rather unique conditions that you might not have experienced in Great Britain?
A lot of frostbite and frostnip. Yeah, frostnip is the sort of minor version of frostbite, if you like, before you really get any tissue damage, severe tissue damage. The other thing I had to do a lot down there that I wouldn't do back in Great Britain was dentistry, because we didn't have a dentist. And in Antarctica, the air is really very, very dry, very dry, very cold. It causes a lot of your fillings. If you've got dental fillings, they dry out. Sometimes they fall out. So I had to replace quite a few dental fillings as well, which is something I would never have to do up here.
How about things like psychological conditions or conditions having to do with sleeplessness? Was that a kind of a different set of issues than you would experience in a more temperate climate and with greater, more equalness between light and dark?
Well, yeah, certainly. Just as the sleep disturbance could be difficult in the summer, in the depths of winter, it could also be quite difficult in the sense that if somebody on the base wasn't getting enough light during the day, during our artificial day with our electric lights, then similarly their body clock could start to run awry and they could start to find it very difficult to get to sleep, and then when they get to sleep, very difficult to wake up again in the morning. And so living in that, you realise when you're living in a polar region, just how what a coincidence it is even to have night and day. When you live in a place which has a night that lasts 3 months, and the period of the year where you have a night and a day is actually very short. It's just very quickly around the equinoxes. And I particularly treasured as well those parts of the year around the equinoxes when I could feel that I had an alternating night and day cycle in my life again.
Well, how close did you actually get to the pole? I mean, because 75 degrees south is really far south, but I would imagine things get even more extreme when you get closer to 90 degrees.
Yeah, absolutely. I made it on an expedition as far as 81 degrees, just which is, 9 degrees from the South Pole. It's a few hundred miles from the South Pole. And there, the continent is starting to climb higher and higher and higher. So as I was alluding earlier, you get up to 3,000 meters above sea level. So the combination of the altitude and the slight oxygen starvation with the glaring light and the ozone hole means the light down there is really extraordinarily abrasive. You know, if you don't cover up your skin with factor 50 and keep your sunglasses on, you can get corneal burns on your eyes just from the glare and the intensity of the glare without ozone hole protection, without the protection of the ozone above.
So the ozone hole is still alive and well in Antarctica?
Well, it's getting a lot better, thankfully. I mean, this is one of the wonderful success stories of, you know, so often in the news we hear about these terrible examples where humanity has not managed to get it together to prevent doing damage to the world. But the ozone hole is really one of the incredible success stories. As soon as somebody realized, within a very short period of time, CFCs were banned, and within 10, 15 years, we are seeing the ozone hole close over. And so the ozone hole is a lot better than it was once, but it still gets thinner at times in the year.
So it's a lot more extreme when you're in Antarctica, where, again, we are experiencing the extremes of climate change at both poles as well. Did you get any sense? And how many years ago was it that you were in Antarctica?
Yeah, it was a few years ago now. I got back in, I was there in 2004.
So actually, at that time, unfortunately, climate change was still being debated. Whether I recall that, NPR did a series in 2004 where they were actually having debates by climate change scientists and deniers. And I was at a conference where the climate scientists, they were going like, NPR is doing the greatest disservice to the science community and to humanity they could be doing. So I'm wondering, back in 2004, when you were there, was there anybody down in Antarctica that was thinking that climate change was not a reality and not being induced by human causes?
I don't know. I mean, the debate is slightly less politicized, I think, in the UK. Most of the actual climate scientists and meteorologists I met there who were carrying out research from Halley with the Halley data, they took it for granted that it existed, absolutely. And now that it's increasingly accepted, you can see, particularly not where I was, at 75 degrees south in Antarctica, climate change, if anything, seems to be making it a little bit colder, a little bit windier. But further north on the Antarctic Peninsula, up towards Latin America, up towards Cape Horn, they're seeing some extraordinary warming. They're seeing emperor penguin colonies that are no longer viable because they need sea ice to be viable for several months to grow their chicks. And those colonies are no longer viable because the sea ice doesn't last long enough. And they're also seeing an acceleration at the rate of glacial calving. Of course, the icebergs that are coming down off the continental ice is accelerating.
And that's a part of Antarctica, I think, that we've seen the most in the news in the last few years.
Yeah.
When we see this dramatic footage of the icebergs calving and sense.
Yeah, that's mostly up onto the peninsula.
Well, I want to talk more about the penguins. Because I mean, that's sort of the come on when I was introduced to your book. And they are, I imagine Empire Antarctica is in some way a reference to the emperor penguins. But let's talk a little bit about what makes these penguins unique even in the world of penguins and what it was like to be living so close to them.
Yeah, well, they're double the size of their nearest rival, if you like, the king penguins of the sub-Antarctic islands. They weigh up to 40 kilos, the great big things. They incubate eggs for the longest uninterrupted of any bird. They have the smallest surface area to volume of any bird in order to try and keep warm. They're the only penguin that has no sort of territorial feelings whatsoever, because in order to survive, they have to crush together in a huddle. And for all other penguin species, that would be intolerable, but emperors have learned to adapt to that and just to crush together. The only penguin that breeds on sea ice, they can go 600 meters under the sea and they can stay down under the water for over 20 minutes, a single breath. Yeah, they're extraordinary creatures. They're amazing.
Well, it seems there's, well, I think a lot of us were introduced to some of the lesser known traits of the emperor penguins by that film, March of the Penguins, I think, a few years ago, which was a bit anthropomorphic, but I thought I learned some very interesting facts, and it was very powerful to see the penguins. And I, one of the things that really struck me in that film was seeing how they, when they're huddling to stay warm during the winter, and they're also incubating, and these are just the males that are doing this, is that correct?
Yeah.
The females are off feeding at that time, that they cycle through so that they take turns being in the middle of the huddle and being at the edge of the huddle. Was that, did you ever witness anything like that?
Yeah, absolutely. No, I witnessed that. Because the colony was one of the largest in the Antarctic, was about 20 kilometers away from my base. So I used to, I went down there every week or so, but I couldn't go down every day, unfortunately. It required a bit of a skidoo ride. But we had a hut down there that we could sleep in for a few nights in a row and spend time with them. So I used to go down whenever I could, and I spent time with them through that winter when the males complete this four-month fast. Yeah, so for 4 months they don't eat anything at all. They just nibble on ice to for their thirst while they're incubating the egg. And so for two of the months, two of those 4 months, they're incubating the egg. And the huddle itself, the huddle of up to 30,000 penguins, because it's only the males, just moves very, very, very slowly but constantly. It moves in order to prevent itself melting through the sea ice, because they generate great heat. Penguins' body temperature is hotter than humans. You know, they're up at nearly 100 degrees Fahrenheit, and so when they're moving in their huddle, they will melt right through the sea ice if they don't constantly shift onto new ice. So as you sit there on the ice with them, they're quite happy to nudge along beside you and gently move you out the way. And the whole huddle will just gradually move past you and through you.
Now, how close are they huddling together? I mean, is there inches between them, or are they actually
contact? No, they're
contact?
Touching. Yeah, they're all touching.
Like we would do if we were camping and very cold, and we would huddle with our friends.
Absolutely. And they shuffle very, very slowly, all touching when it gets that cold. And they're crying. They make these calls every so often to one another, which seem to keep them together. But ornithologists think that they're in a sort of a slow wave sleep during that time. You can imagine for all those months of fasting and walking, just walking, sometimes in blizzards, sometimes in clear and very cold temperatures, they must shut off in some way. They must almost hibernate in some way, and apparently they do. Their brain waves change.
So during that period when the females are off feeding, I take it that you said that they are incubating the eggs for 2 months. So another part of that four-month period, I imagine that the chicks are hatching?
Well, yeah, a little bit at the end. But most of the fast is actually before they start incubating the eggs. So they have to start fasting when they leave open water, and then it takes them a while to walk to the mating ground, and then they mate, and then it takes a while for the female to lay the egg. And then the female passes the egg over to the male.
And that's quite a scene. They show that in the movie. Did you get to watch any of that?
Yeah, I saw that, yeah.
What is it like when the female's passing the egg to the male?
Yeah, well, it's very fraught moment, because if it stays too long on the ice, then, of course, the embryo, the chick inside, will die. So, it's very nervous, nerve-wracking to watch.
But did you were all the passages that you saw successful?
Yeah, and I saw, well, most of the ones that I saw were successful, but unfortunately when you go down and see, when you go down into the penguin colony during the winter, sadly, you do see scattered over the ice abandoned eggs that have rolled off the feet of a parent penguin and then just frozen and then been abandoned. It was very, very common, sadly.
So to see. What do the males do who are... who don't have eggs to incubate? Do they go swimming with the females? Or?
No, for the most part, they stay. Yeah, so there's a lot of males that don't have eggs that stay.
And then at the end of this period, the females return?
Mm-hmm.
And then the males go off to feed?
That's right. And the females get there at a time in August, it is at Halley. So the sun has just come up after 3.5 months. The females have come a long, long way from open water, so it takes them the best part of 2 or 3 weeks to actually reach the colony. So they've been there fasting for a couple of weeks even to get there. And then the male has to walk that distance in reverse. And then over the subsequent months, it takes about 4 months, 4 or 5 months for the chick to go from hatching to when it's ready to fledge and be left. And over that period of time, the time that the parents have to swap over gets less and less as the open water advances towards the colony.
So then how are the chicks fed when the females return? Do they kind of like wolf-like where they regurgitate their food, or is there stuff somewhere there for the chicks to eat?
Yeah, no, the females have a lot of, they carry a lot of fish and krill in their stomachs to feed the chick. And the male, by the time that the chick has hatched, the males are, they're obviously been starving for several months, and they feed the chick, give it its first feed, actually with strips of their own stomach. They slough them off, a very kind of fatty, rich strips of lining they slough off to be able to feed the chick. It's an incredible experience.
Well, this morning on Locus Focus, we're talking with Gavin Francis, who spent 14 months in Antarctica, I guess about 9 years ago, and he has written a book called Empire Antarctica, Ice Silence and Emperor Penguins, and we're talking right now about the amazing life cycle of the emperor penguins. Now, what did it feel like to go down and watch the emperors who were, you know, there in the element and who have evolved somehow to adapt to this extreme element, and then go back to the comfort of your station? I mean, did you wonder why you were there when you see the way that the penguins have adapted and how they live in Antarctica?
Yeah, no, I mean, I felt very relieved, of course. We're not adapted to those at all. You know, human beings are tropical mammals, and we've managed to head up into temperate zones, but really, I was very conscious of the fact that I was only surviving there because of lots of foods and fuels and comforts imported from another world. And they're the only species that can survive those coasts through the winter.
There are
some seals that live there through the winter, but they live under the ice where it's a bit warmer and keep their breathing holes open. And there are no other species that survive above the ice.
And actually, some of those seals are the main predators for penguins, aren't they?
Yeah, leopard seals. Yeah, leopard seals don't stay that far south through the winter, but Weddell seals do. Leopard seals and orcas are the main killer whales. They're the main predators of the penguins. Yeah.
Well, actually, that was one of the things I liked the least about March of the Penguins, was showing one scene where a leopard seal gets a female penguin, and then there's this kind of maudlin narration about how that leopard seal has ended two lives, the life of the female and then the life of her chick.
Mm.
And
she saved the life of the leopard seal.
Exactly. And I mean, you saw some predation when you were there, and I was wondering, what was your response when you would watch? I mean, because the penguins are hard not to love. I remember seeing them in the Bronx Zoo when I was a kid, and they were my favorite species. And I think we identify with penguins in a way, because in a way they look a little bit like people.
Yeah, because they're bipedal and they waddle around in a very cute way. Yeah, no, of course, the whole ecosystem has to work, and there has to be, the leopard seals and the orcas have to eat something. And I'm delighted that as human beings we've managed to work out a way to avoid being predated on most of the time.
Except by each other.
Yeah, except by each other. And I'm very conscious of the fact that leopard seals and killer whales have to eat something. So.
And also there's a bird that also predates the chicks.
Skuas, yeah. Skua gulls and giant petrels make it that far south if they can get a chick that's small enough. But one of the wonderful things about the emperor penguin having evolved this extremely grueling life cycle is that when the chicks are hatched in August, it's still too cold for most of the predators to make it that far south. And so it's a largely predator-free environment.
So is that a reason, do you think, that that's why the emperor penguins are there? Because they have found a place where there are the fewest predators? And that's why they take, I mean, the worst challenge in many ways for them is the weather.
I wonder. I mean, there are lots of reasons, I think, to do with why they've managed to survive in that little pocket. But, yeah, they have actually, although I talked about finding a lot of eggs, abandoned and frozen eggs on the ice, they have very good survival rates, emperor penguins, compared to most penguin species. Better than most. which is hard to believe considering the environment. Yeah.
So what kind of lessons did you learn to apply to your own life from the winter that you, or the year that you spent watching the Emperor Penguins?
Well, I was so grateful to them, really, in that they, while I was living in this very silent, very beautiful, but very empty and elemental place, they were a great reminder of the life that was going on over the northern horizon, that somewhere there was still a community of the living, and I was in some way related to that. So that was part of the beauty of why I liked going down to visit them. And also, I was just, of course, impressed by how patient they are and tolerant. I mean, we mentioned anthropomorphism earlier. I don't want to get too anthropomorphic. At the end of the day, they're penguins, and they have behaviors that are just about surviving in that environment. But I was impressed by how patient they can be, how tolerant, how still they are for those months, and tried to learn something of that from them, as much as a human being can learn from that.
How well do you think you've been able to apply those lessons of patience to your own life?
Yeah, well, perhaps I haven't been able to apply them all that much since coming back from the Antarctic. I don't know. But the thing about having gone through that winter with them is I realized very much that, you know, it was quite a difficult experience in some ways, not in others. In some ways it was comfortable, but in some ways it was difficult. And not just environmentally, but psychologically. And having gone through that, that's given me lessons and strength that I can hold on to for other difficult times and experiences in my life.
And think about what it's like to be a penguin incubating that egg.
Yeah, well, I mean, some of your listeners will know about Apsley Cherry-Garrard, who was with Scott on his second expedition. He wrote a magnificent book called The Worst Journey in the World, a very famous book about the Scott expedition. And Apsley Cherry-Garrard said, there is no creature on Earth that has a worse time than an emperor penguin. Just because they have to fast for so long, because their environment is so difficult. And so in some ways I agree with him. You know, if you think your life is bad, think how bad it would be to be an emperor penguin.
Though it also seems that there's, I mean, I don't think that the emperor penguins think that they have it bad.
Yeah, they're exactly, they're perfectly adapted to their environment.
I mean, I think this is where climate change comes in when you think that they are actually endangered, as are the polar bears in the north, by a warming climate that might be easier for us to survive in, but for them, they wouldn't be able to live in the Falkland Islands, for example.
Yeah, absolutely. They would need to make some fairly major adaptations. And at the moment, their life cycle is completely dependent upon sea ice. And there are very few bits on the Antarctic where they would be able to nest, or to incubate chicks on land. So if the viability of the sea ice continues to get worse and worse further south, then they're going to start being in trouble.
Well, the last thing I want to talk about is the international quality of the Antarctic and how important that is. Actually, when I was a kid, I remember the International Geophysical Year, which I think was like 1957 to 58.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
And there was a lot of exploration of Antarctica, and that's when I was probably about 8 years old, so I developed my fascination of Antarctica back then, and also learning about the penguins. That was a major international cooperation in doing scientific research. Yeah. Is that a tradition? How important is that tradition to Antarctica? Because it seems that in the beginning there wasn't a nationalistic race to the South Pole, and there were, in fact, Halley Base doesn't have a Union Jack on it. I mean, there's still a certain amount of nationalism on some of the stations there. But how important is it in your eyes for Antarctica to remain an international, depoliticized region where its purpose is not just for research, but maybe as a seed ground for saving the rest of the Earth?
Yeah. Well, you know, we do ask a lot of it, but it's a big enough continent to be able to take all these ideas and metaphors we keep putting on. The International Geophysical Year was a magnificent example of state cooperation, particularly between the Americans and the Soviets. I mean, as I'm sure you remember, but there was also a lot of rivalry going on there then. I mean, that was when McMurdo and the South Pole Station were essentially built, and at the same time there was a lot of awareness the Soviets were building three massive bases on the Antarctic continent at the same time. The British contribution to the International Geophysical Year was a bit more modest, but they organised the transcontinental crossing with snow cats and dog sledges. I don't know if you remember that, the Vivian Fuchs and Edmund Hillary expedition.
Oh, yes, I do remember that, actually.
Yeah, they crossed. Edmund Hillary, fresh from conquering Mount Everest, he flew in from the New Zealand side of the continent, and he had tractors and laid depots from McMurdo towards the South Pole. And there was a British chap called Vivian Fuchs who came from the sea ice, very near Halley, actually. He started very close to Halley and went to the South Pole from the Latin American side. And they met in the middle. They met in the middle and had had a few glasses of champagne, because by then the South Pole station was built. So that beginning, if you like, for the Antarctic bases, a lot of the Antarctic stations that are running today owe their existence to that period of time when they were established in the 50s. Halley was established for the International Geophysical Year, for example, 56. It was the first men wintered. And that feeling of cooperation between bases is still very strong. When planes fly in, for example, we had visitors from the German stations come to visit us at Halley, and the Americans have often helped out the British when we've had problems with casualties and needing casualty evacuation. And similarly, the Argentinians, even this closest station to the British base at Halley is actually an Argentinian one. And although there may be squabbles in Buenos Aires and in London about what we do with the Antarctic and territorial disputes, actually, when you're on the ice, nobody really argues. Everybody cooperates and everybody gives and shares and helps out one another. So, yeah, I hope that Antarctica can be a beacon for international coordination and organization.
Maybe we should have the world leaders have their summits at Antarctica, and they could discover there's more important things in the world than squabbling about political issues.
Yeah, well, there's when you're wintering in the Antarctic, midwinter, so that's our northern hemisphere midsummer, so June 21st, 22nd, a whole series of messages from all the world leaders come in, and it's magnificent. Yeah, we had a message from the President of the United States. We had five messages from various Indian government dignitaries. We had messages from all over the world. And, I put some of them up online, actually. You can see them on gavinfrancis.com. I've got images, and I've got some of these messages from world leaders up online. So, yeah, if anybody's really interested in having a look at those, I would recommend taking a look.
So now that you're settled and a family man, do you think you'll ever go back to Antarctica?
I've got three young kids just now. So I think I'll need to hold off for a few years. But I would love to go back. Yeah, I would love to go back when they're a little bit older. Maybe I'll go with my kids.
Sounds like a great outing. Good family outing.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Gavin.
Yeah,
it's been great talking with you.
Thank you for having me on the show.
Sure. We've been talking with Gavin Francis, author of Empire Antarctica. And you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locusfocus. Next week, we'll explore four iconic trees of California with my guest, Jared Farmer, author of a new book, Trees in Paradise. My engineer is Sam. We're going to go out with some music by Abby Lincoln. I'm Barbara Bernstein. Thanks for listening.
KBOO, we have a dynamic community of 500 volunteers doing everything from front desk work, janitorial work, community reporting, hosting information booths, clerical support, news writing, documentary making, engineering live music, operating soundboards, working in the music library, and many, many other things. KBOO absolutely depends on volunteers to carry out the work of the station. We are always looking for new volunteers. We have monthly volunteer orientations, which is the first step in getting involved. Contact KBOO Volunteer Coordinator Annie Haynes about the next volunteer orientation at 503-231-8032 extension 231 or at volunteer@kboo.org.
This is KBOO Portland, where the time is 11 a.m. Disability Awareness is off today. Instead, we'll hear an excerpt from Letters to Washington, featuring an interview with Rebecca Williford, attorney with Disability Rights Advocates, about what happens to people with disabilities during natural disasters. At 11:30, Roberta Hall hosts Health and Healthcare Forum with guest Dr. Ted Shetler. Don't miss it. Stay tuned.
This is Letters and Politics. I'm Mitch Jezerich. Well, one thing we can assume safely is that in the Philippines, after Hurricane Haiyan, the people most affected are going to be the elderly, people with disabilities, and the poor. And we know that that's not so unusual because the same dynamic happened last year here in the United States in New York City after Hurricane Sandy. In fact, last week, a federal judge in New York ruled that New York City and its disaster plan was out of compliance under such things as the Americans with Disabilities Act. Well, for more on all of this, I'm joined by Rebecca Williford. Rebecca Williford is a staff attorney with Disability Rights Advocates, and she was an attorney who worked on this case. Rebecca, thank you for being here.
Yeah, thank you, Mitch, for having me. Happy to be here.
Good to have you here. Talk to me about what happened to disabled people after Hurricane